for the week of February 16th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 481, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. 19 episodes until we hit the big 500. I hope we have a fundraiser when we hit 500 episodes.
Well, it would be nice, to earn, anything, actually, anything. We would take literally crumbs to do this. In fact, we do take crumbs. And by the way, the big 500, you say? Well, 500 is the new 400.
Okay, good
Isn't
to know.
That like 50 is the new 40?
All right, sure.
So, yeah, something like that.
We're just a young podcast at heart. Is what you're trying to say.
And if you listened to we'll put our beginning at the end as we tried to start our show. Something very funny happened that made us all feel like teenagers again.
That's true. But we're young and nimble at heart. We cover all the topics. What are we going to talk about this week?
Nothing, because literally nothing happened. The Oscars are over, and then nothing happened for the entire week.
Everyone's exhausted.
Yeah, well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're still dissecting the Oscars, in fact. Parasite and the explosive popularity of international TV shows on Netflix and the like should mean the U.S. will finally catch up with the rest of the world and embrace subtitles. Plus, independent cinema is delighted by the latest hire at the Arclight Cinemas. By the way, a familiar face. In the Middle Kingdom, movie theaters are still shut down as the coronavirus impacts China, Hong Kong, and the entire region in entertainment, business in general, and of course, even politics. On Inside Baseball, we'll talk about the fallout from the lame Oscars joke about the bad special effects in Cats. Turns out there's a real-life sad ending to that story. Plus, the latest scuttlebutt on the WGA battles with talent agencies. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Deadline, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, the New York Times, you, our listener. Charts around the world, India, China, although the China chart is fairly empty right now, but we pull it all together, and we can tell you the number one movie around the world is Sonic the Hedgehog. It grossed $100 million last week. And in North America, it's President's Day. So Monday is a holiday. That's the day we're recording. That means Sperling's darling kids are at home instead of at school. And it grossed another $13 million on Monday. We're not including most of that Monday figures in this weekend roundup. So Sonic the Hedgehog is now at $113 million worldwide. It's the best opening ever for a video game movie.
I'm trying to remember. What other video game movies were there? Like
a million of them.
I know, but whenever somebody says it's the best this for that,
Well, the highest grossing. Yeah, video games have sort of a curse. Last year, Detective Pikachu did okay. That was all right, but a lot of movies have flopped. Dungeons and Dragons, which is not technically a video game but a board game. Warcraft. There've just been a lot of video games trying to turn into movies, and it hasn't usually worked. It did work here, and I think it was. Was it Variety or Hollywood Reporter? They had a nice story comparing the backlash to the first trailers for Sonic the Hedgehog and Cats. Cats had elaborate new technology. Sonic the Hedgehog was trying to capture a classic video game character. Everybody saw both of those trailers and said, oh my God, what have you done? Sonic the Hedgehog had weird teeth and he looked too human, and Cats just had bizarrely weird and bad special effects. What happened in return? The people behind Cats said, it's too late. We're coming out in December. There's nothing we can do about it. We can't retool the whole movie. Sonic the Hedgehog, Paramount said, you know what? We're going to delay the release date. We're going to take more months and more money and fix the main character in our movie, the look of the main character. And they retooled Sonic the Hedgehog, the star of the movie, and gave him a new look so that people wouldn't go, ugh. And it worked.
Yes, they gave him bigger eyes and a bigger, different teeth. And they were very upfront about it. I mean, at Expo Cine, listen to me, at Cine Europe last year, they were going over their, I think it was Paramount, was going over their release schedule and what titles they had coming up. And they did talk about the fact that they delayed that movie so that Sonic could you know, go to the orthodontist and get some new teeth.
That's right. What if they had done that with cats? What if they had said, first of all, we don't have time to finish the special effects we're doing. And secondly, is it possible and do we want to try and retool the look of it? I think it was too elaborate. In Sonic, you're talking about the visual look of one character. In Cats, you're talking about the entire infrastructure of the movie, the size issue and ratio of the cats in the rooms, which seemed to vary from scene to scene, the actual look of every single character in the movie. It was probably too big a lift to try and change it or do anything about it. So I think they were stuck in that case. But Sonic, they did say, hey, people are very unhappy. We think we can fix this. Let's do it.
I also think there is a bit of, throwing good money after bad. And I think that you kind of know when you've seen, the film at a certain point, okay, there is no fixing this to a point where it will actually make money. So why would we continue to pour more money into something that won't make money at all?
Well, nonetheless, Cats is still in movie theaters, though mostly by now it's the dollar discount movie theater. It's playing in my local town. I'm going to go see it. Our in-house film critic, Aaron Rich, went to see it, and he said it was perfect in a classic Joel Siegel Good Morning America type review. He said he saw the movie. There were about 30 people in the theater, and everybody had a blast. He said the audience was really fun. I feel like this could be a new cultish midnight movie. People could see this film and just go, yeah, it's so bad, it's good.
You know, I wonder, you mentioned Sonic the Hedgehog and everybody's reaction to it. But of course, everybody's reaction after they fixed it was, it's still going to be horrible. And the LA Times review was, I think it started off with, I can't believe I'm about to write this, but Sonic the Hedgehog is actually pretty good.
Well, there you go. Well, that's the number one movie around the world. It grossed $100 million last week. Now with Monday's charts filling up the coffers, it's at $113 million worldwide. At number two around the world is Birds of Prey, another Marvel flick. This is the story of Harley Quinn. It grossed $61 million this week. It's at $142 million worldwide. It cost about $85 million to make. So we're looking at it to get to $250 million to say, okay, you saved your bacon. Not a big launch, not a great successful new series, but you haven't lost your shirt. That's probably where it will end up.
And which is actually a very good thing, because now you know what you have? One more thing on Warner Max or whatever they're going to call it that Netflix doesn't have, that Disney Plus doesn't have. And it was basically free programming for the most part, because you know what? You broke even theatrically.
Free programming. I don't think that's the right way to look at it. At
number I'm pretty sure that there are literally studio executives right now going, my friend, not free.
At number three is 1917, the Oscar winner that scored big at the box office. $45 million this week. It's at $330 million worldwide. Right below that is Bad Boys for Life, the Will Smith and Martin Lawrence action comedy. They're older. They're members of the AARP, but they're still fighting crime. $32 million this week. That's at $370 million worldwide. At number five is Parasite, a huge week for the Best Picture Oscar winner, a landmark film, the first foreign language movie to win Best Picture. It made $29 million this week. It's at $204 million worldwide. It's moving up the charts in North America. It's already, I think, in the top five of the highest grossing foreign language films of all time at the North American box office. It's doing great worldwide.
Yeah, I mean, it opened on 941 more screens than it had last week.
The flip of a switch. Easy to do. At number six is Doolittle. $23 million this week for the would-be franchise. That's at $180 million worldwide. Pretty much the story is written for that movie. Doolittle is now playing in 66 territories. I don't know if it even opened up in China. That market is a wash for so many.
I don't
movies.
Think it did. I think it was supposed to open up in February, and guess what? We're almost at the end of February, and it's not going to open up.
No. At number seven is Blumhouse's Fantasy Island. I was sort of tickled by the idea of this movie, a horror film spin on the Saturday Night Escapist TV series. No, Mr. Rourke being Mr. Nice Guy, that's for sure. It only cost $7 million to make, and it opened to $20 million. Nobody liked it, but it made money.
So what is it? Tattoo go, deep plane, deep blah.
It's a, very funny. It's a woman this time, I believe, his assistant or his second in command. And she does say the plane. She's very excited. At number eight is The Gentleman. That Guy Ritchie crime drama grossed $14 million. It's at $75 million worldwide. I missed the joke or the story on that one. Our friend Reverend Andy went to see the movie and he felt guilty because he hated it and he wanted to leave. And then the projector broke down. And so not only did he leave and not come back, but he took money so he could see another movie for free. And he felt guilty because he almost never walks out of a movie or virtually never does. And he wanted to on this one. And then God said, fine, okay, I'll give you a break. he, so thank you, Lord, or Microsoft, whoever messed that up. At number nine is Little Women, $13 million this week. That's approaching the $200 million mark worldwide. A great success for Greta Gerwig. And number 10 is a new film. This is the second new film on the... No, Blumhouse's Fantasy Island is also new. It's the third new
and
film
Sonic
on the...
Sonic the Hedgehog?
Right. Yeah. Sonic is the... And Fantasy Island. And now The Photograph. The Issa Rae... Lakeith Stanfield, how do you say his name? I'm a terrible person. He's the guy from Atlanta. He's a terrific actor. It's a romantic drama pegged to Valentine's Day. It opened to $12 million and some very friendly reviews.
I saw him on...
he was on The View.
And he was on The Daily Show. And he was just like, yeah, I don't care. Like, you know, because...
So Lakeith Stanfield, what do you mean he doesn't care about what?
Like
he's cooler than cool.
Yeah, like he was just like, yeah, you know, because Trevor Noah was asking about being on the red carpet and how he sits down sometimes and how he wears like costumes on the red carpet. He's like, yeah, I don't care.
Well, no, asking silly questions about the red carpet. What's more important than the red carpet? Virtually everything. And he's a terrific actor. Of course, he's in the series Atlanta. He's in Uncut Gems and Knives Out. Sorry to Bother You. Get Out. He's got a great track record. He was Snoop Dogg and Straight Outta Compton. But he's a terrific actor, that's for sure. Lakeith Stanfield. And I have not seen The Photograph yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
Glad it did well. $12 million for a $16 million movie. Yep. Not bad for an opening weekend in one territory.
Absolutely. At number 11 is Jumanji, The Next Level, the Dwayne Johnson flick. $10 million this weekend. That's about to hit $780 million worldwide.
I don't know if it opened up in China. It may have, actually.
Yeah,
that did.
I take
that back. I think it did, yeah.
That did. And number 12 is Ice 2. It's a sequel. This is the Russian ice skating romantic drama. It's sort of a Russian version of The Cutting Edge, where a hockey player and an ice skater fall in love. This time, they want to have a baby, I think. It made $8 million on its opening week. Right below that is Jojo Rabbit. That's at $80 million worldwide. And then right below that, we have another new film. It's Honest Candidate. It's a Korean comedy about a politician who is running for office, and she is cursed by some people. They put a curse on her, and she is forced, to tell the truth. Hilarity ensues, and of course, it helps her, I imagine, win the election. But it grosses $5 million on its opening week, and somebody in Hollywood is saying, remake. That should be remade in a heartbeat. Star Wars made another $5 million. Cats made another $4 million. Thank you, Aaron. That's at $73 million worldwide. Good Lord. Right below that is a new film. It's Downhill. This stars Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Will Ferrell. It's a remake of a very good French movie called Force Majeure. And boy, is it bad.
Wait a second. It was a Swedish movie.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I'm a terrible person. It's a Swedish film. And boy, is Downhill bad. It grossed $4 million on its opening week, which is probably better than it deserved. Right below that is Knives Out. That's at $303 million worldwide. And then Malang. Yes, I think that's how you say it. It's an Indian romance. Clearly. And do they celebrate Valentine's Day in India? That's a good question. But it is an Indian romance opening on what is Valentine's Day in North America, at least. That made $4 million this weekend. It's at $8 million total. So it opened up, I believe, on February 7th. But well-timed to a romantic holiday. Of course, Valentine's Day has its roots in, I believe, Christian tradition. It doesn't mean that they don't celebrate it in India. Now here's a movie, a mystery movie. It's called The Best Years. And if you type in The Best Years, you find a lot of films, including The Best Years of Our Lives, but not a movie that came out in 2020. It grossed $3 million, and I know nothing about it. If you do, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We'll read your emails at the end of the show during our listener correspondence section, or you can call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We'll play your voicemails, although we will not play all of you, like, telecallers. Unbelievable. We got 12 calls.
Your Cantonese phone call telling you that the ICE is coming after you and you need to pay them money.
Yeah, we literally got 12 calls this past week. We're also on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle, or Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
So cherry picking the rest of the chart, I'm looking for new movies. There's Emma, which is a new version of the Jane Austen novel. It's directed by Autumn de Wilde, making her a very good photographer and music video director, making her feature film debut, at least feature film in terms of fiction. I think she's made some concert films. That opened to $3 million. In Germany, the film Nightlife is a romantic comedy. That opened up to $3 million. And I believe in two movies in India. One is called The Lost... No, good Lord. This is the French film. It's The Lost Prince from the director of The Artist, whose name is Michel...
Hazanavicius.
Very good. It made $2 million. It's a family-friendly movie about a father and his daughter who share stories with her, and then we plop into that world a la The Princess Bride and something like that. But he's the star of her fairy tales every night. They're having adventures in, you know, their fantasy land. And then she falls for a boy at school, and suddenly she wants that kid to be in her stories that he tells. He's like, wait, what? I'm getting displaced by a kid? So that's the adorable premise of that film. And then in India is a movie called Love Ajkul. It's a reincarnation romance. Two people who fall in love and then fight and bicker and fall in love again in future lives. It made $2 million this week. But here's the twist.
Isn't that like kind of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind?
Well, no, it's not. It's not like that at all. But this movie is, in fact, a reincarnation itself because it's a remake of a 2009 film done by the same director. He remade his own film. It's a movie about reincarnation. My head is spinning, but maybe I can understand Hinduism better if I go see it.
Yeah, I think you probably should. Now, where can we see it? We probably can't. That's the problem.
Well, I don't know. You're saying it didn't open up in North America? I don't know.
That was my way of talking about subtitles.
Oh, well, no, you're skipping ahead. I think you should be talking about independent cinema. If you want to see movies like The Photograph, well, that opened up pretty wide. But if you want to see some other movies that are international in flavor or don't have a wide release, but they're still movies worth checking out, you want to go to an independent cinema chain like Angelica Cinemas or Sunshine, if that's still around, or, of course, Arclight. And there's good exhibitor news, and in terms of independent film goers, if you like that type of movie.
Well, this weekend, actually, Portrait of a Lady on Fire from Neon.
A terrific movie. I've heard it's one of the best of the year. I want to see it. It reopened on 22 screens. Everyone should go check it out.
Okay, in six markets, and it earned $500,000 this weekend. Not bad.
It had a $20,000 per screen average. Not bad.
Yeah. Yeah, Neon doing quite well with its pickups. So Ted Mundorf used to be the head for two decades of the Landmark Cinemas here in the U.S. And then
they were bought out, and he was summarily fired.
Yes, after about 10 months, they were like, "Hey, thank you for sticking around during the transition. Now feel free not to come in tomorrow or ever again."
That's right. And people were upset because Ted Mundorf has been a strong champion of independent cinema for many, many years. He's seen as a real, you know, bullhorn, somebody who really amplifies their love for movies and the type of movies that we love to see more of, like Portrait of a Lady on Fire. So his loss was felt across the industry.
Right. But then the Arclight, which is a kind of an offshoot of Pacific Theaters, they're owned by the same company. They hired him as their president or their CEO, or
it's a top position at Arclight.
Yeah. So yeah, not bad.
So it seems like that would be a great thing. And certainly a lot of the movies they would play have subtitles. The best picture winner is Parasite. I suddenly had a shock this morning when I realized the Oscars were just last Sunday. It seems like they were 3 weeks ago, a month ago.
I know.
But no, the Oscars just happened. Parasite just became the first foreign language film, non-English language film, to win Best Picture. That's very exciting. And does this mean a breakthrough for subtitles?
You know, I don't know, but I will tell you this. From the moment that Lost, well, maybe not the moment, but yeah, starting with Lost,
the TV series, yeah.
The TV series, I began to notice more and more subtitles creeping into just primetime television series on broadcast networks. And I thought, wow, people are really getting used to reading subtitles.
Right.
On television.
We've talked about it on our show. Lost, 24. There are a lot of TV shows that have international settings, and they're more and often not having people in, you know, Iran pretend to speak English. They speak in you know, their native tongue, and then we get subtitles.
Right. And I thought, well, this is a good sign. Well, I think it's all led up to, well, this, you know, Parasite winning. And I don't know about you, but I went to Twitter the day after and Facebook the day after the Oscars. The number of like clips of people, and I don't know why people do this, but they have their cameras on, their video cameras on their phone as the Best Picture winner is being read.
They get their reaction shot.
Yeah, the reactions of people just exploding when Parasite was named. Like, you know, you'd see like some party where like 200 people like exploding, cheering the Parasite won. I'm like, wow, I guess there was a lot of pent up, like, thank God the Academy hasn't lost their mind and they picked the right movie moment.
Well, I think they could have picked three or four movies and a lot of people would have been happy. It was a year where there was strong support for a lot of films. But like you, I think it's important to remember most of the world watches movies with subtitles all the time. China is the number two market, and they are far more open to Indian, Korean, Japanese, and other foreign language movies than the U.S. And of course, they all watch English language titles too. So we're catching up with people, and TV has been doing it for quite a while now. You see streamers like Netflix, they are bankrolling, you know, TV shows in Germany, TV shows in Spain and Korea, and therefore they want everyone to watch them. They don't just want people in Germany. They want everyone to watch Dark or whatever that sort of German Stranger Things show is. And so they are promoting and pushing those shows. People are watching telenovelas. I have friends in Alabama who are not Spanish speakers who watch Lord of the Skies, that big telenovela. So that practice has spread. Parasite's win, I think, is symbolic, but it's absolutely helpful.
You know, in 2002, 2003, I was in Cannes, and there were a whole bunch of journalists from Japan and Korea and Norway and Sweden and Europe, and they were all tapping away at their little 12 button phones. You know, they had
12
you
button
know,
phones.
They had a flip phone, you know, where okay. They had the candy bar phones, and there was no smartphone back then. And I said, "What are you guys doing? You're like tapping, tap, 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 tap. Are you, like, how many numbers are in that phone number?" And they're like, "Oh, we're not calling anybody." I said, "What are you doing?" "Oh, we're sending a text message." I said, "What's a text message?" Well, eventually, America caught on.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, as you're saying, there was a whole bunch of people out there in the world that read subtitles, usually from English films being, you know, translated into their own language. Well, we're now going to get on that bandwagon.
Yes, that's right. And it's a great development. But and Parasite is benefiting at the box office, but certainly not in China or Hong Kong or Singapore or probably a number of other territories. I doubt it's doing as well in Korea as it should because people are staying at home. I have friends.
You know, I actually pulled up the Chinese, you know, when you mentioned Ent Group's China box office tracker.
Mm-hmm.
Yikes. One film had any gross at all. One film. And it was only less than $20,000, basically, it made.
That's
It Man 4. Unbelievable.
That's just a crazy stat to see. And I have friends who live in Singapore. They are not going out. You know, they're not hiding in their home in fear, but they're certainly not going to movie theaters. They're not hanging out in public places a lot. And that's happening in a big chunk of Asia. It's really upsetting the market. Obviously, our first concern is for people's health and everyone to get better and to have not this turn into a horrific pandemic that could really, you know, cause lives. Right now, it's just an inconvenience is the best way to put it. You know, people have died, of course, but it's not nearly the level of an annual flu in North America. But, it, you know, this is how pandemics happen. We want to be smart and follow medical guidelines and do what makes sense. So our first concern is, of course, for people's health, but it does impact the industry. We have the Hong Kong TV and Film Convention. It's called FilmMart. That usually happens in March. It has been postponed till August. James Bond, that new film, No Time to Die, I kind of like the Billie Eilish theme song. Well, that has canceled its China publicity tour and I believe the Chinese opening. So they're saying, we're going to wait until we know we can make our money. I'm assuming it will be weeks. I think this is mid-February. I think by mid-March, things will be back to a little bit normal unless it gets really bad. People will have more information about how long it incubates. Doctors and medical people will be able to give better guidelines about what's appropriate to do. And people can stop, you know, reacting in fear and start to live their lives based on what, you know, the scientists say is smart things to do. And probably we'll be okay to go back to the movies and live our lives within a few weeks once we sort it all out and see what's going on.
Yeah, you know, I've talked to a couple of colleagues in Shanghai who said, you know, we don't understand. Everybody keeps talking about like they're staying in, that nobody's on the streets. The people are on the streets. We're going to work.
Well,
and I'm like, well, you're not in that province. And they're No.
I have friends in Singapore. They people are, flights in and out are canceled in terms of business. People are not showing up for business meetings. They are not going out on business trips because people don't want them to come to their country. Some countries have banned people. And they say, absolutely, it's a notable change at malls and restaurants and movie theaters. People are not going out anywhere near the numbers they normally would in Singapore. I can't speak for the rest of Asia, but we certainly know it's having an impact, not just in Wuhan, but all over China. I mean, the entire national box office is shut down. It's having an impact in Hong Kong. It's having an impact in Asia in general, in terms of business disruptions. And people are not going on business trips. They're certainly not headed to, you know, to Guangzhou or Hong Kong for business meetings right now. They're saying, yeah, let's do it on Skype.
You know, if you wanted an experiment to prove the whole Earth is flat Thomas Friedman philosophy that, you know, we're all connected economically now, mm-hmm. Well, guess what? This very well could be it.
We don't need it. We've known it for centuries now, since international trade began in the 1300s or whatever. The world's been flat for quite a while. But it's a big deal when people recognize the reality that's been staring them in the face. So that's always helpful.
Well, you said that it's a big deal that the Earth is flat or something like that. But, you know, and you said it went back all the way to the 1300s, which in that time frame, people did believe that the Earth was flat. But then in 1492, we proved it wasn't because of the whole Columbus thing.
Not actually true, but anyway.
Yeah, I know that, but then you just ruined my whole long, extended, very long, very, very, very long transition into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. We told you that nothing happened this past week, right? We went straight from box office into Big Deal, Big Whoop practically.
Okay? Yeah, but we got some good stuff here. Numbers, numbers, numbers. You're going to love it. Statistics, percentage increases.
I'm watering at the mouth.
Exactly.
Our first story, the ratings company Nielsen, okay? You can already see the drool in the corner of my mouth. Well, it has some numbers for you. They say people have access to some 650,000 individual titles via streaming and cable and renting and subscription video on demand, which is why Michael and I are giving up the show so that we can start watching them one by one. We'll pick it up when we're done with 649,000 of them. How about that?
Sounds good.
Now, we're counting every sitcom, every drama, every movie, every miniseries, you name it. And no, they are not counting each individual episode, okay? So Friends has 236 episodes, but they are counting that show as just one title.
Wow.
So again, 650,000 different TV shows, movies, and so on. And yet I still can't stream the Zucker Brothers classic TV comedy Police Squad, okay? Go figure. Anyway, Nielsen also said in households with over-the-top streaming capability, the amount of watching nearly doubled in the past 2 years, and most of those households subscribe to more than one service. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a very big deal, and we know that streaming has overtaken and influenced so much, movies, TV, music, you name it, and it just continues. I mean, the number of viewing has doubled in the past 2 years. That's crazy. That's a lot of watching. That's billions of hours. I know it's true for me, and I'm sure it's true for a lot of other people. In fact, I got to go buy a new Apple TV because our old one just broke down, and my mom wants to watch The Crown.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, speaking of Police Squad, only 9% of those shows that they are listing there are exclusive to streaming. So over 90% of them are available on cable, or you can rent them on, you know, or whatever. So only a tiny percentage is like exclusive content that you can only find on Netflix or Amazon Prime or somewhere else. In fact, 9% is pretty high in my mind. But another 16% are exclusive to linear TV, stuff that's available on linear TV but not available on Netflix or Amazon Prime. So 75% of those hundreds of thousands of shows can be accessed via other ways. So like Police Squad, you know, you can rent it on DVD. It's discontinued. You can't buy a new copy, but you can find a used copy. And if you're lucky, Netflix or somebody has a physical DVD. So if you want to rent it, they may have a copy still left, but you can't buy a new copy on DVD. You can't stream it anywhere. A lot of television has fallen through the cracks. Despite that big number, that's not anywhere near all the TV that's been created and you might want to watch. And good news, Police Squad is coming out again on Blu-ray in a few weeks. It's a Blu-ray, great. It's a great
just
show.
In time for you to try and find a player.
Yeah, but it's a, I'm hoping that means they've remastered it or whatever, and maybe somebody will pick it up for streaming because it's a great show.
Now, I just wonder, can you imagine the poor schmo who had to count all those titles? Can you imagine if they were like 400,000 and somebody came in and went, hey, what are we doing for lunch? Oh, crap. Where was I? Mm-hmm. Now, if you want proof the streaming is exploding in popularity, guess what? You want to know why HBO Max and Peacock and a revamped CBS All Access are on the way? Well, look no further than Roku, okay? Streaming hours on Roku grew 68% to a total of 40 billion hours. In all for 2019. Its ad revenue is up 70% in the fourth quarter alone. Its overall revenue in that same quarter is up 50% to just north of $400 million. It just added a record 4.6 million new users in the fourth quarter and now boasts 37 million in all. Okay, 36.9 million, but you know, more signing on every day. So hold on, wait for it. Yeah.
Boom.
37 million. Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal.
Yeah, it's huge. I didn't know that, frankly, I'll be honest, I wasn't really sure that Roku had a subscription streaming service, but they do. I thought they were just like a device that you bought and put on your TV.
I thought they were too. But I mean, you can get the Apple TV device and not subscribe to Apple TV Plus. I guess you can use the Roku device and not subscribe to Roku. But I believe when they are talking about this, they are saying that all the streaming going through the Roku device is 40 billion hours. They're not talking about just people who subscribe to their service. You know, they're talking about people use their device to stream 40 billion hours of TV last year. So Apple TV's device streams a ton of stuff. I don't belong to Apple TV, but I'm using their device to stream hours, and that is being counted.
Yeah, and I'm looking at this now, and man, they have a lot of stuff on there. You know, I might have to actually cut the cord.
Well, so they've got the Roku channel. They've got what, a mini bundle?
Yeah, they have these mini bundles.
Well, there you go.
I might have to. It's just the news and sports that I'm in. I might have to, you know what? I've got to go. I've got to do some math.
Let's finish up the show.
Oh, okay. Well, hashtag me too? Well, that actually means you too, as in you need to take action. The time for apologizing and saying you'll do better is over. That's the message we get from the authors who pen bodice rippers. I love that term, bodice rippers. And the artists, by the way, who make cinema en français. That's a fancy French word for in French. At the Romance Writers Association, a crisis over the muffling of voices calling out prejudice has led to the entire board of that organization resigning. They all resigned. We talked about this a little while ago. Mm-hmm. The membership will vote in new board members, and one can assume they will be attuned to the needs and demands of today's diverse writers in the romance genre. Now, if we head on over to France, the entire board overseeing the Césars resigned. Now, the Césars are the
French Oscars.
Yeah, and they hate being called the French Oscars, but they're the French equivalent of the Oscars. Now, here's the thing. The 4,000 plus members of that academy won't be voting on the new board members. And you might be asking, well, why? And that's because they don't have any say in the board. And that, say members, is just one more sign of how out of touch the leaders of the Césars are. It came to a head after the members as a whole showered Roman Polanski with nominations, and then the governing body blocked legends like Claire Denis from taking part in key events leading up to this year's César Awards. Mon Dieu! Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, it's a big deal. It's the changing times that we live in. Rather than going, oh, it's like, no, it's long overdue. God knows why they stopped Claire Denis from coming to something. Shouldn't they be happily inviting her to come every single time? You know, she's one of the great French directors.
I thought, like, Agnès Varda, when she was alive, mm-hmm. may she rest in peace. I thought it's like one of those things, like,
of course,
Catherine Deneuve, you just invite. If you're holding an important event in French cinema,
you want them
you
there.
Invite them. Yes, yeah.
Of course. So
it's required for them to be there.
But this is there's constant stories all the time. I love these. There's a French author who has boasted about being a pedophile for decades. It's what he writes about in diaries and novels. And it's all he discusses, how he loves little girls and little boys. And he is facing possible criminal charges. And his powerful friends, we're talking prime ministers and top people in fashion, are running for the hills. The New York Times had an interview with this guy, and he is so bewildered. he doesn't recognize the world he's in. It's like the older people who say, oh, well, I had to put up with that harassment. You should too. Just tough it out, lady. It's like, no, actually, people shouldn't have to deal with that. This guy can't understand. For his entire life, he's been describing going on sex vacations to other countries and raping 8-year-old boys. And everybody in France said, oh, isn't that charming? He's so bold and adventurous. And now they're saying, oh, you might go to jail. And he does not understand at all what has happened to his world. Similarly,
well, here's what I would say. Welcome to the 19th century.
Yes. There's also a French mayoral candidate who had to quit his election. He was a family values candidate, though I believe he's with Macron, so he's probably progressive as opposed to the way we in America would hear family values. That would mean right wing. In this sense, he was just touting his family values, but he had personal text messages and videos that he sent to another woman, and those were posted online. So one person on the hard left was quoted in the paper saying he regretted the Americanization of French political life in which people, quote, have to apologize for having lovers or mistresses, end quote. And finally, in Scotland, a top government official in that country's leadership had to step down for texting a 16-year-old boy repeatedly over many, many months. It was like, yeah, hi, whatever. And the guy's like, so what are you doing now? You know, it was just creepy and awful. So that kid was of age, the age of consent. The person was openly gay and in a relationship. I believe he has a husband. But people just said, you know what? We don't like that. So it's a changing world, and the romance writers are catching up. The Cesars are catching up. The whole world is changing, and it's all for the better.
Well, here's my question. With the Cesars, was it just are people they don't like Roman Polanski all of a sudden?
Well, the actual members, it wasn't the board that gave nomination. It was the entire body that gave nominations to Roman Polanski and his latest film and showered it with, you know, a stream of nominations. It was one of the most nominated films of the year. And people who are upset about that said, this is one example of how undiverse the entire body is. So yes, we voted for it in general. That's not on the board, but it is a reflection of how staid and backwards and how resistant to welcoming in new members that the Cesars are, just like the Academy is pushing to bring in new people and actively and aggressively trying to do so and saying, hey, here are our numbers this year. 20% of our members are now internationally based. So these are all steps forward. We need to do more. In France, they don't see that same energy and focus on making the Césars and the people who vote on them reflect the French film industry.
Well, the satellite radio company SiriusXM and SoundCloud have been dating for a while now. But now it's official. Aww. Okay, SoundCloud was already partnered with Pandora, the Sirius radio service. Now the host company has invested $75 million in the platform that helps... Oh, you know what? I said Siri. Siri.
That's hilarious.
And now Siri is like talking to me. Well, okay. Well,
and you know, now they're listening to our podcast. Enjoy.
Yeah. And by the way, we're on iTunes, just in case you're wondering, Siri.
But we're not on Spotify.
Okay. Well, or SoundCloud, which I should probably change that. The Siri. ESXM is taking a minority stake and two seats on the board of SoundCloud. They're not getting married yet, but they are definitely an item. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal because SoundCloud really turned themselves around. They were on the ropes. They got a new fund of investments. They said, we can make this baby work. And they did. So that's a real credit to them. It doesn't happen a lot, so it's nice to see.
Well, you know, here's what I would say. In part, it's a big deal because when Sirius and XM merged, you know, they said, we have to do this to survive. You know, that we have competition. We have competition. Look, there's all these streaming things like Pandora and SoundCloud and all that. Now they're going out and buying all of those things. So, you know, they kind of created a monopoly in at least internet radio, or not internet radio, satellite radio. And now they're strong enough to go out and buy the very competition they cited as competition.
Yeah.
Anyway. You keep hearing about it all the time, by the way, this next story, that indie bookstores are back, baby. Hardcovers are back. At least hardcover books. Down with ebooks. And yeah, you know what? Crowdfunded bookstores / community centers. Yeah.
We love them.
Oh, we love them. We wish we could agree. The truth is that thousands of stores shut down and each border store was equal to about 10 or 20 or who knows how many tiny, poorly stocked indies that go hat in hand asking for funds before they even open. Also, a majority of new books hitting the bestseller lists for fiction and nonfiction are sold in the ebook format. So there's no windowing there. And unfortunately, in 2019, bookstore sales fell almost 6%. Oh, and the new owners of Barnes & Noble admit the big chain of superstores is kind of, the best way they describe themselves is a hot mess. Big Giller, big whoop.
Well, I think it's a good wake-up call and a reminder of the reality of the bookstore biz, that it's great when indie bookstores open, but a tiny... I just went to a new one here in Birmingham. Did I mention this on the show prior?
No.
Oh, I went... A new indie bookstore opened up. Someone said, hey, a new bookstore. They sent me a link to a store. Said, oh, great. I'll go check it out and support. It's like this tiny space. It's exactly what you would expect. You know, they have little handwritten notes on the shelves about their favorite books and this and that. It's tiny though. And they don't barely have any room to have, you know, speakers. You know, they don't have room for that. It's just not that big enough. And it's in a poor look. And I thought, oh my God, you know, is this a hobby? Like, this is not going to survive. It's you can't compete this way. It's heartbreaking, but if you want to be an indie bookstore, you really have to have the footprint so you can have events and gatherings and become a community center. And it's just a tiny, tiny little space. And I thought, well, I wish I could, you know, be excited for you, but I don't see this working. I actually thought it was a used bookstore until I went there and realized it was all new books. And I thought, oh God. And I was friendly and polite and tried to be as nice as I could, but I just left and thought, oh Lord, that's not going to last a year. So it's really hard to open up a bookstore. And when we have these stats about bookstore chains and physical bookstores and how much sales are down, that really doesn't even give you a good idea about bookstore sales, book sales in general. You know, we don't have no idea.
Because Amazon has most of them.
Well, they're the number one bookstore seller in North America. They are by far number one in ebook sales. And so highlighting those bookstore sales just doesn't give you a clear picture. It's very frustrating, but that's where we're at right now. And I wish we had better figures and a better sense of the overall biz.
Well, you know, I here in Los Angeles, well, here in the United States, Macy's is closing all these stores.
Oh, yeah.
My daughter needed to go to a party. So I said, oh, you need a dress. Macy's is having a sale. Let's go. They don't have a juniors department anymore. So there's no, you can't buy clothes there if you're a teenager. And I thought, well, there's a missed opportunity. All you need to do is have, you know, fashion shows on the weekend. You know,
well, they have fashion shows. Lots of those chains do have fashion shows. That's been going on for decades.
Yeah, well, I don't know what's going on at Macy's, but...
Well, they've had fashion shows in the past.
Well... Yeah,
that's a good idea. They've probably every idea we've had has been tried.
No, okay, fine.
Yeah, well, let's. The devil made you say it, didn't he? It was the devil that made you make that suggestion.
It was. In fact, we've talked about Lucifer on the show before, haven't we?
I don't think so.
Well, Lucifer is this show that was on Fox, right? And it's based on a Neil Gaiman... is it a story or idea or I don't know, but Fox said, yeah, we're done with this. And Netflix said, yeah, we're not. We'll pick it up and we'll produce it. And they produced, I think, seasons 4 and 5.
That's right. It was on Fox for 3 seasons.
Right. And it is one of the most streamed shows around. Not just
how do you know that?
Because of a report that was released recently that at the ICTA...
By Nielsen or by Netflix or by whom?
You know what? I don't have the slide, but they had a list of... Right. Stranger Things, ironically, was not number one.
Well,
it was like
we're
number
just
two.
Saying that's a black hole of information as well. So, you know, we do not know...
It was ComScore. Sorry.
Right.
It was ComScore.
Netflix made season 4. They are looking at doing it for season 5, it looks like.
Right, and it's produced by WB TV, so Warner Brothers. And I can tell you, Warner Brothers likes this show because they are making all of their money in one territory. So they make the show, they then sell it to Germany, where they basically...
They make their budget back, you mean, from one territory.
Yeah, so everything else is gravy.
So it's a big, big hit in Germany.
A big hit in Germany, a big hit on Netflix. It's one of their most watched shows. And... You know, it's one of those things where all of a sudden you start hearing like everybody's watching it. You're like, really? Nobody talks about it.
Well, you wonder why it's not on HBO Max. You know,
because
Netflix doesn't
yeah.
pick it up. Maybe it'll go on to HBO Max. I mean, it's your own show. You're making money overseas. keep it going. But of course, if it's on HBO Max, you want to keep it out of that territory. But that's another.
I ran into one of the post-production supervisors and post-production producers on Lucifer, mm-hmm. and he was telling me, like, yeah, it looks like they might do another season. And, you know, the showrunners just do not want to do another season.
Why not? Why not? What do you?
I don't know. I guess they feel like they're out of ideas. I said the same thing. I was like, well, why not? Why? First, why are they? And then, you know, I had earlier that day, ironically, saw that ComScore report. Why don't they want to do it? And he was like, I think they're just out of ideas.
Well, it was from a comic by Neil Gaiman, a character created by Neil Gaiman, Sam Keith, and Mike Dringenberg. The TV series was developed by Tom Kapanos. He has White Famous. That's his show since then. So that's a TV series starring Jay Farrow. It's already canceled. So as far as I can tell, he doesn't have any new projects in the works. So he doesn't seem that busy.
Well, you know who's probably not busy right now is the people behind the show Cats.
Well,
the movie Cats.
No, the special effects company that worked on Cats. That's what you're trying to talk about. Last week, it's Inside Baseball time. That's what you want to say.
That's pretty much what I wanted to say, is that we're going to move on to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, to all of our listeners who suggest that we actually place little musical interludes in between, hey, we agree with you. In fact, we probably wouldn't have run into each other if we did that.
Well, last week we talked about James Corden and Rebel Wilson on the Oscars. They thought they were making fun of themselves by appearing in costume, referencing the big flop movie Cats that they had just starred in. But actually, they singled out the special effects as being awful. We thought that was obnoxious and they should apologize. And it raises the question, why do the Oscars continually make jokes about behind-the-scenes talent? This is not a one-off mistake here. They do it all the time. Every year, practically, they're like, ha-ha, special cinematography, ha-ha, sound mixing, ha-ha.
Cinematography or craft services, right, as Will Ferrell thought it was. Right. Yes.
Stop making fun of the people you are supposed to be celebrating. But here's the bad thing. The special effects company that worked on Cats is an Oscar-winning company. It was up for some other awards that Oscar night, or at least the movies they worked on were. And they announced right after or right around the Oscars that they are leaving Vancouver, Canada. The Motion Pictures Company, there's a generic name for you, by the way. Boy, that doesn't tell me. Motion Pictures Company, sounds like it was created in 1902. Nonetheless, they're a well-respected effects company. And they said they are seeking better tax breaks in Montreal or elsewhere, perhaps overseas. So it's a real blow to Vancouver. And if they stay in Canada, it's a pointless reshuffling of jobs from one location of Canada to another, which doesn't help anybody or grow the industry. It just, you know, encourages them to hold out their hand for tax cuts that aren't creating new jobs. So it's very sad for the people who are involved in that show. And I found out about it because one of the people who worked on it tweeted out about it. Right? Those effects companies, to be fair, live hand to mouth because studios demand they do work on the cheap at the last minute. It happens all the time.
You know, if you ever want to understand the visual effects business as it has grown and become today, look at the end of Avengers, okay?
Yeah.
That's a great example. And you see not one, not two, not three, but 10, 12
every
companies.
Every company around was given some work on Avengers, right?
Yes. And here's the thing. I always say, like, doing work for a studio, like service work like that, it's like, in a way, and maybe this is a bad analogy because it's like having cancer, cancer.
Whoa. Bad analogy. Bad analogy.
Let's just put it this way. The studios squeeze and squeeze and squeeze to a point where you're paying them to do the work.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe they should be back in-house again.
It's untenable.
Why aren't they in-house? You're always going to want special effects on every movie you do.
It's too expensive. It's way too expensive to maintain all of that and the overhead and the human resources overhead. It's way too expensive to maintain your own effects firms.
Paying enough for other people to do that either. They keep going out of business. It's not too expensive. You just don't want to spend the money. It's not too expensive. Right. You have to spend the money. You have to support the people you're asking to work on your films. You say, well, I don't want to have employees. I want to have freelancers and subcontractors and people I don't have to give benefits to. Yes, that's the problem, that you think that's an expense that you can ignore.
It's kind of like this.
You want them to work on your movie, but you want them to do it for pennies and not get reasonably reimbursed.
It's not like when MoviePass was around and you're thinking, right now I can tell in Michael's brain, he's like, how is he equating MoviePass to any of this? However, you're saying, hey, we should be paying, you know, the going rate. Well, like when MoviePass was around, we were more than happy. We knew it was untenable, okay? We knew that that would not last forever, okay? Without a doubt, it was going to go under. But while it was around, we'd take advantage of it. And so the studios, in a similar fashion, are saying, well, while these, you know, individual effects firms are around, we'll take advantage of it until we have to, like, open our own studios.
No, this is the bigger trend of every company not wanting employees. Nobody wants employees anymore. They want independent contractors that they can screw over and have no bargaining power, have no way of demanding basic, you know, benefits and packages that they deserve. They just want to say, I don't want an employee. I want to surf. That's the problem here, that they don't want to pay for the work that they're asking for. And the equivalent of MoviePass would be, I'm a chain. I think that's a good idea. I'm AMC. I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it properly so I won't lose money on it. I think it's a good idea that customers want, and I'm going to do it in a way that allows me to keep making a profit. But anyway, we found out about this effects company and the fact that they are abandoning Vancouver and that all those people are out of work because one of them tweeted about it. Eve McRae, one of the people who was fired, tweeted a clip of James Corden and Rebel Wilson on the Oscars and said, hey guys, I haven't watched all of the Oscars, but I assume those two were really classy and thanked me for working 80-hour weeks right until I was laid off and the studio closed, right? End quote. You know, they've done Oscar-winning work, and it's just a shame that Corden and Wilson, you know, and the people at the Oscars didn't realize making fun of your own team is not a good idea.
You know, I went to see a play over the weekend called Revenge Song, and it was at the Geffen Playhouse. And the second act opened in the characters. It was kind of this, you know, wacky musical comedy. They were in the audience and they were pretending like, oh, are we in an opera house? Are we? And one of the characters turned around and said, oh, you know what? Old rich white people? Yep, we're in the theater. And I thought, you know, hey, are you biting the hand that feeds you? We're here paying to see you. You want to make fun of us? All right. You know, we're not laughing at ourselves. You're laughing at us.
What did they do?
They basically turned around. And they were trying to pretend like, oh, where are we? Where are we? Oh, we must be in a theater. Are we in a theater? Oh. And one of the characters turned and looked at everybody in the audience and went, old rich white people. Yep, we're in the theater. You know, and I just thought, yeah, okay, we get it. Funny. Only old rich white people go to the theater, go to see operas. We get it.
What were you doing at a queer vampire cowboy musical?
Revenge Song?
Yeah.
I don't know. That I have a subscription to the Geffen Playhouse.
Was it good?
That's what was playing. It was okay. Mm-hmm. It wasn't great.
It's a fascinating true life story, though. Julie d'Albigny, I think, I don't know how to say her name, but she was a queer 17th century French swordswoman and opera singer. She did it all.
Yes, and they tried to do it all on the stage, and they did, you know, there were some moments. Well, there were some moments.
Well, the WGA is trying to do it all. The Writers Guild of America last week took a step. Their members voted and overwhelmingly supported the stance that they are taking. And we said, you know, we don't see how there's not going to be a strike. Well, this week we can say, maybe there won't be a strike. What happened?
Well, you know what? I guess one of the big five talent agencies...
No.
They sat down with them?
No.
Is that what you're talking about?
No, four of the big five. According to that president of the WGA, they say they have had substantial talks with all but one of the big five talent agencies. They say we have spoken to four out of five of them, and they say we all want to make a deal. We don't want to strike. Now the pressure continues. They have a lawsuit. They are signing smaller agencies, and they are pushing studios and producers in negotiations with them to join their fight and say, we won't work with agencies that haven't, you know, signed up and re-upped with the WGA. And sticking points remain. They want agents to work for them, not against them. That seems reasonable. They want no more packaging, and they basically do not want agencies to be owning the means of production. That sounds Marxist, but they're saying, we don't want you to be our boss. Basically, we want you to be in the business of talent agents rather than making movies and TV shows, because if you are, you can't represent us. So those are all still happening, but they claim they have spoken to four of the big five talent agencies and had substantial talks, and that everybody wants to make a deal. Now, I like to imagine that they're lying. I like to imagine that they haven't spoken to any of them, but they're announcing
they did. They called up, they spoke to the switchboard, and the switchboard said, yes, I can put you through to Richard Lovett at Creative Artists Agency. Yeah,
right, but they say, oh, no, we've spoken to almost everyone but one, which means every agency who hasn't spoken to them says, well, I'm not speaking to them. That means everybody else must be. And they go, well, are you speaking to them? And they go, well, I'm not speaking to them. Are you? And they're like, you're lying. I know you're speaking to them because I'm not, so I know you are. And maybe creating infighting, and they'll feel like, oh my God, we better start talking to them because everybody else is. So that's not true. That's not what's happening, but it is a breakthrough. At least it's helpful to hear that they're all talking. I don't know why it would be a secret, but it's good news, I guess.
Remember, the whole agency thing is just one part of their contract. Remember, they want, you know, residuals on streaming, and they have a whole other litany of issues that have nothing to do with agencies.
They'll pay them residuals.
No. I'm talking about a strike.
Well,
the contract with the AMPTP is up this year. Mm-hmm. The WGA portion of it, sorry, the talent agency portion of it is just one of their demands.
That's true. That's true. But breaking through with the talent agents, getting them back on board, having that big breakthrough, I think would give them a lot more leverage with the studios to say, we are serious here. They have knuckled under and dramatically changed their business. You need to do it too, because we're having more business than ever, more shows than ever. Everybody's making more money than ever, except for the writers, and we're not going to stand for it.
Well, that brings us to our obituary section, where we have some sad news, actually.
Oh, absolutely. Very sad.
At the age of 40, the host of a hugely popular show, Love Island, she was, you know, it's a reality show. She died. Her name was Carolyn Flack.
Right. She's very popular and well-known in the UK. She broke through on the ITV show Love Island, though before that, she won the competition show Strictly Come Dancing in 2014. Then she started on Love Island in 2015, became a big celebrity in her own right. I mean, she dated Prince Harry. She dated the two Harrys. She dated Prince Harry and Harry Styles of One Direction. You can imagine her life was a media frenzy. And the tabloids in America are really bad, but they make the tabloids in the UK, you know, I mean, they're nothing compared to the UK tabloids. Please notice Harry and Meghan, by the way. So her life was very stressful. She was under the spotlight, and then she just had a huge legal case coming about physical assault on her boyfriend, a tennis player, once pro, known as Lewis Burton. That broke out into the news. She was charged by the police. She was going to court. The Sun tabloid in particular called her Caroline Whack instead of Caroline Flack and just mocked her endlessly. And she died by suicide at 40 years old. She cracked under the pressure, didn't feel she could reach out to anyone, and tragically, you know, has died by suicide. We've seen this a lot in South Korea. We know a lot of people face the pressure of the media and they don't commit suicide. It's not a reasonable response. Ask for help if you need it. But this is, you know, it's a really bad culture. And in fact, Love Island, this is the third year in a row that they've been linked to suicide. In 2018, a female contestant died by suicide. In 2019, a male contestant died by suicide. And now in 2020, the host, Caroline Flack, has died by suicide.
Well, the former host, yeah, but well, still, no,
she
yeah,
was
the host.
She was the host. She stepped down to deal with this legal issue, but they constantly said the door is open for her to come back. You know, the boyfriend said he wanted their relationship to continue and he didn't see himself as a victim, which may have something to do with men not wanting to see themselves as abused. You know, men can be abused just like women mentally and physically. I don't know what's going on there, though. I know he made a public comment about how heartbroken he was. I hope he's getting the support he needs. She is, you know, this is a dreadful thing. People are in the public eye. The media pressure is so intense. It's really difficult and painful, and mental health in general is not talked about enough. So, you know, hopefully people will say, you know what? People do have thoughts of suicide. Reach out for help when you do.
Also passing away was Joseph Shabalala. He was the founder of Ladysmith Black Mambazo. And if that name sounds familiar, you probably remember them when they teamed up with Paul Simon for many of the tracks on his, his landmark album, Graceland.
That's right. They brought their style of music to the world. And they toured with Paul Simon. He had sort of a review type show for that tour. He brought a lot of the big stars who were on his album and Miriam Makeba and people like that. And he would come out perform a song or two songs and then leave, and another act would come on, and you thought, oh, I just want to see Paul Simon, you know? But you know what? Everybody was great. And Ladysmith Black Mambazo in particular, they're really great on an album, but when you hear them in concert, that power of their synchronicity, of their in-syncness that they have, it's breathtaking. And
they're harmonizing.
Yeah, it's so much more impactful when you see them in person than hearing it on a recording. And we saw them live. I mean, by the end of that concert, you know, when they would come back out, they were getting as much, if not more, applause than Paul Simon, because they were just a terrific performing troupe. I got to interview with Joseph Shabalala, and they became huge superstars in their own right. They won 5 Grammy Awards. They did dozens of albums. They had TV commercials and, of course, tours. They specialized in the South African Zulu style of music known as isiXhosa. And Ladysmith is his hometown. That's why it's called Ladysmith. Black refers to an oxen and their farming roots. And Mambazo is a chopping axe. And that hints at their badass vocals. So they're basically saying, we come from Ladysmith, we have roots in farming, and we can sing like nobody's business. Their 1973 debut album, Amabutho, was the first by a Black artist or group to go gold in South Africa. So they were a major troupe breaking down barriers in South Africa long before Paul Simon got wise to them. Joseph Shabalala was ailing. He retired 4 years ago, and his son, Sibongiseni Shabalala, took over the musical leadership of the group. They've paused their tour, but they will continue, like a lot of great vocal groups like the Blind Boys of Alabama. New people keep coming in and giving it fresh blood. So the troupe that he founded will continue forever, but it's a sad passing for Joseph Shabalala.
You know, I was going to read that obituary, but then I realized, oh my gosh, there's about 50 words in this obituary that I cannot pronounce.
Well, I did my best to try and learn the right pronunciation. Hopefully I did okay.
Well, if you can say isiXhosa.
Yeah, I mean, it's just fun to say Shabalala. It's just a musical name, Joseph Shabalala. And chatting with him was such a treat. He was so kind, so friendly, generous. He's heard every question 1,000 times before, but he made it seem fresh and new. It was just a great personality.
Well, we'd like to chat with you. In fact, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call, leave us a voicemail. The number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com, and that's where you'll find all those ways to subscribe to us. iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, we usually can be found. We are working on Spotify. Again,
Showbizsandbox. Are we? Are we?
We are. Showbizsandbox.com, our website. Again, we're also on Twitter, @showbizsandbox. Is our handle, or facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can like our page on Facebook. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They have their own website. It is whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found online, and every week he's got a new and exciting website for us. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's shabalalaforever.com.
I really was hoping it was going to be isiXhosa.com.
It could be. isiXhosa.
Yeah. Now, that said, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice. For the week of February 16th.
Hold on a second. I said, I'm ready to record, to which my mom immediately said, are you recording your podcast in there? Yes, I am. Just about to start. Okay. If you can't shut the door between us and your bedroom door. Cool. Let's wait.
You know, anybody listening to this section of the podcast would think we're two teenagers.
We essentially are emotionally.